From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
There were 14 meetings of compromise, and on Sunday, Mother's Day, I heard we were $475 million short, and I made some suggestions, and we got to an agreed, balanced budget with revenue. But now we hear that we're not ready to vote on it yet. Do you think it's going to get any better? Seriously?
What happened today was a political show orchestrated by the Democrats who are trying to portray agreements that do not yet exist.
And the details that you just said will come later are really important as to whether this works or not.
The defeat of some of these bills today will not defeat our goal in reaching an agreement.
That's the Republican Senator Bill Brady. Before him, a couple of other Republicans, Chapin Rose and Jason Berrickman, both senators, and the Senate President John Cullerton, a Democrat we heard from as well. We're another week closer to the scheduled end of the spring session. And was there any progress made toward getting a budget deal? It may depend on who you ask. We'll talk about that and more today. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's the director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. In our Statehouse studio, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter. And in Chicago, Tony Arnold. He's the Illinois politics reporter for public station WBEZ in Chicago. Tony, thanks for being with us again.
Well, thanks for having me.
Brian, I'm going to start with you. I asked the question, was there any progress made? So try to sort out for us what all took place this week.
Yeah, well, we had more negotiations, and Democrats, much as they had done last week, and people could be forgiven for perhaps thinking we had mistakenly played the intro from last week's show. The Democrats said, okay, this is it. We need to have the vote this week. We're done negotiating. It's time to move. We got to get things over the House. We've only got a couple of weeks of session left. So they held a series of votes on the so-called grand bargain to see sort of put Republicans on notice, is what the Democrats said. So they started out with some things that had been passed before. They had to vote on them one more time because they took away that language that sort of chained everything together and said if one thing fails, they would all fail. And they did start out getting some Republican support on one bill would make it easier for local government to consolidate with each other. Two Republicans voted for that. They were going to change the state procurement laws, which is this really complicated system they put in that they made some changes to a few years ago in the wake of the Blagojevich administration that a lot of people on both sides of the aisle have complained about that governs how the states and universities go about making purchases, everything from food for the prisons to gasoline for state police cars, things like that. That had all 22 Republicans voted for that. Few Republicans also voted to expand gambling in the state of Illinois. But then once you started getting into school funding, property taxes, borrowing to pay off old bills, as well as the budget bill itself, things seemed to break down.
So is there some agreement at least behind the scenes that income taxes are going to go up and maybe there's going to be a property tax freeze and we're just not quite at the point where all the numbers are finalized but we're inching closer, or are we inching apart from where a deal would be?
They say that we're inching closer. Both sides will say we're still inching closer. We have some ways to go though. So but they both say that they can make it. I think in terms of both sides, even though nobody likes to say this, especially on the Republican side, we've had the governor, telling people again in an editorial in the State Journal Register this week that he protected them from a tax increase. But the Republicans will acknowledge that taxes need to go up and need to go up for a number of years in order to begin to dig out of the hole we're in. But what the Republicans say is they want a property tax freeze that lasts as long as whatever income tax hike there is. And so if the tax hike is going to go for 4 years like the last one did, they would like a 4-year property tax freeze. And Democrats have not been able to get on board with that yet. And that seems to be one of the big sticking points. There's also still disputes over the education funding, how the state pays for local schools in Illinois and how much and in what ways to change that system. So those seem to be a couple of the biggest areas where there's still some disagreement.
Charlie, it's not uncommon to have these, like Brian said, disagreements at this point in time. I mean, even though we're just a handful of days till the scheduled end of the spring session, oftentimes these things don't come together till the very end anyway. So at least they're talking, and it does seem as though there's some give and take going on. Are you optimistic at this point they'll get it done?
Well, what I would point out, though, is, yeah, back in the days when I was a reporter, working reporter, yeah, it was common about this time of the year. There'd be disagreements. You'd be trying to work it out. But don't forget, we're like 2 years past that point when we should have been having inching closer and working out these disagreements. We've gone 2 years without a budget. And unless they can get their act together, probably within the next week and a half, we'll be looking at a third fiscal year without a budget. And the thing to recall is that after May 31st, it takes extra votes for anything to become law that would become effective immediately. So it strikes me that reasonable people could probably agree and kind of split the difference. But some of the things that are separating them, apparently it's as much ego and personality and my way or the highway. And the focus has been on the Senate and the two caucuses, the Republican caucus, the Democratic caucus, trying to work something out among themselves. And you still have to deal with the House. And the House will go through a similar type of procedure. Whatever passes from the Senate will have to go to committee. It will have to be debated in committee, considered, brought out on the floor. Chances are the House will disagree with some of the Senate's points, make its own changes, send it back to the Senate. So the clock is ticking, and inching towards agreement would be fine if we had another 6 months to get it done. In this case, maybe we should be sprinting toward agreement instead of inching.
And Tony, let me bring you in here. Your thoughts on where things stand at this point.
I guess what I'm kind of watching for the next week here is really what the House starts to do in terms of the bills that did pass, that did have an agreement, in particular the gambling bill. You know, it's interesting. We're talking about a dozen bills here that were, I guess, a part of the grand bargain that nobody's really calling a grand bargain anymore. And it's like, if you take them all away, does that, any other year, this would be a really big bill, the gambling bill. How many years have we talked about the end of session, adding a casino to Chicago and other parts of the state of Illinois, adding more casinos? And if you just take that one, for instance, just the gambling bill, it's already in the House. I see it's already been assigned to the executive committee. And is that going to just start moving regardless of whether the Senate does agree on a couple $100 million of cuts still that have to be detailed to get a bipartisan agreement on that? That's kind of what I'm wondering right now, where it's, yeah, I think there's a big questions about what the House is going to do if the Senate does reach an agreement on an overall spending plan and how to pay for it. But I also think that there's just some basic questions about, well, if some of the, you know, procurement reform, the local government consolidation, casinos, those are big bills. I think the House might just start taking those up and sending them to the governor on their own. While we're all kind of, you know, just over here watching to see, are they going to do this budget or not?
And Brian, your thoughts on that as well. I mean, the fact that Charlie pointed this out, that the House still has to get involved. Are you hearing anything that, you know, the House is not on board with some of these ideas? Have you heard anything to that effect?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the House does have its own prerogatives, as they like to say, and that's one of the things that seems to motivate House Speaker Michael Madigan, is making sure that, you know, he protects the interests of the House as an independent institution within the independent legislative branch of government. We've almost forgotten, it feels like, between all the state news we've been following, all of the national news, this like a month ago, but earlier this week, the House Democrats did hold a news conference sort of saying that they were making, trying to meet the governor on some of the economic ideas that he wanted to push forward in improving the state's economy. But they came up with some very Democratic ideas for doing that. One of them was a sort of an alternative minimum tax for corporations. They talked about working with the governor on workers' compensation, which I think the governor would be on board with, you know, in some ways, although probably not the ways that they're necessarily suggesting. They want to, you know, have the state sort of provide a competing state-based workers' compensation insurance company to compete with the private sector that they contend would help lower costs. I mean, the governor has not seemed to go for that idea. So the House Democrats have so far not really shown a lot of at least overt interest in the grand bargain. There are some independent members who signed a letter saying, you know, urging the senators forward and saying they were, you know, supporting them sort of independently. But in terms of as a group, I think that really remains to be seen.
Charlie, it seems as though, while we can talk numbers here and people can be a part in those areas, the lack of trust on both sides, I mean, I think both Republicans not trusting Democrats, vice versa, really is about as high as I've seen it. It seems as though, you know, nobody wants to say, well, we could push this off and work on it later, things like that. It's just, they're just not going to go that route because they don't trust each other.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate observation. And from my perspective, the lack of trust is just as bad, if not worse, than it was during the years that Rob Blagojevich was governor, and the 1 year he had to actually put in writing his commitments on certain funding priorities called Memorandums of Understanding, which was unheard of in modern Illinois financial history because the lawmakers did not trust him to keep his word. Throughout Blagojevich's administration, we had no capital plan because legislators would not trust him that if they gave him the authority to borrow money to build projects, that he would put them in a particular lawmaker's district, or in the alternative, he would use that ability to work against lawmakers or to punish them if they wouldn't go his way. So it's the same lack of trust. And in fact, that's why the so-called grand bargain bills were initially linked all together, because there wasn't the trust that used to be there back in the day when it would be, okay, Tony, you want this bill, I want that bill, I'll vote for yours, you vote for mine, and we'd have a handshake agreement. Well, in this case, initially, these bills were all linked, so if Tony's bill wouldn't pass, mine couldn't pass either. And that, to me, spoke to the distrust that exists. And then you have the governor, and there's still questions in a lot of people's minds. Does he really want to get anything done, or is his goal to kind of destroy some of the institutions that he thinks are inimical to the state's best interest, namely public employee unions, be they teachers' unions, be they state workers, whatever. And so he's willing to sustain whatever damage it takes to our social safety net to achieve his goals. There's a lot of people who think that may be his end game, and so not having a budget really doesn't bother him that much. It's a totally toxic atmosphere, probably just as bad as if not worse than it was in the Blagojevich years.
On that same note, Charlie, I think that a lot of people are also wondering whether House Speaker Madigan really wants anything that the governor can use to declare any sort of victory in the remaining 2 years of his term or first term, depending on whether he is successful in his attempt to win re-election. It seems most people believe that Senate President Cullerton and Senate Republican Leader Redonio are genuinely working towards trying to stave off a budget, but they're more institutionalist, you know, traditional-minded people, and they've certainly worked hard to portray themselves as the grown-ups in state government this spring legislative session. But for as many Democrats are wondering, you know, as the governor, as I said earlier, has published an op-ed in the SJR talking about how, you know, we can't have a bad deal, and I believe the phrase he used was, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it was something like a bad deal for taxpayers is worse than no budget, which is, you know, not what the bond rating agencies have said about Illinois, for example. Well, they, you know, they said yeah, you know, a bargain is better than no deal. But people are also think that about the speaker, too. And there are a lot of Republicans who, you know, maybe sincerely want to get things done, but think that the speaker is always going to, like Lucy with Charlie Brown in the football, going to pull that football away at the last minute. And that's, as we said, a toxic atmosphere down here.
Go ahead, Charlie. I think you wanted to.
No, I was going to say that Madigan's track record is caring about protecting his members pretty much more than anything else. So the question in my mind is his desire to deny Rauner a victory, is it stronger than his desire to help his members provide a record for themselves when they run for re-election? And so I think there's more pressure probably on Madigan from his members concerned about the disastrous impact of the budget impasse on social service agencies, higher education, kids trying to go to college, all that stuff in their districts, maybe than there is on Rauner from the Republicans.
Tony, let me ask you this, because I think it goes to that point that Charlie's making. When we are talking right now about trying to get a deal where at least most of the, both of the sides are together, the Democrats and Republicans, and get something to the governor that maybe he can sign. At the same time, if they can't reach that type of agreement, is it likely that we would see the Democrats just push through some type of budget plan? I can't imagine that they want to leave town with nothing having been approved budget-wise, even if it's something that they know the governor's going to reject. Do we think something like that could happen?
Right. If history is an indication, then that's exactly what the House will do, because that's what they've done the last 2 years. Last year, though, what the House passed, the spending plan that the House passed, didn't even pass the Senate to get to the governor because it was so unbalanced. So I think that that's why there's so much tension on what the Senate can accomplish in terms of both a spending plan, a revenue, a tax increase plan, and then cuts. I think to Charlie's point about, you know, the pressure that the Democrats could put on their leader, I think that, you know, you could say the same thing about Republicans, especially those who represent universities that are, you know, that are a really big part of their districts, because that, you know, they're relying on the success of those universities as anybody else. So I think it does go both ways. I guess what I would say is, as far as is there going to be an agreement or what's Speaker Madigan going to think about what the Senate passes, if anything, in the middle of the Senate vote this week, we got alerts saying that Bruce Rauner's re-election campaign got a $20 million donation from Ken Griffin in one lump sum, maybe the most expensive donation of all time. In Illinois, at least.
Well, aside from his own donation, $50 million.
Right.
Yeah, by somebody who's not. It's the most ever by someone who's not actually a candidate for office to his own campaign.
And then you have new ads, TV ads. You know, keep in mind it's May and there's no election this year, but there's all these TV ads about. I just saw one last night. The Duct Tape Dynasty, talking about Rod Blagojevich, Pat Quinn, and Speaker Madigan. These ads are running already, these negative ads against Madigan. And I think if you're talking about reaching a deal, what kind of shape does that put, you know, any kind of deal when there's already negative ads running against a person who's not even up for election for another 10 months.
And there was a time.
That just shows where the mind is. You know, the mind's on the campaign, not on the budget. Right?
There was a time when $20 million, which was what I believe that donation was, that, and it's not been that long ago, that amount right there would be enough to fund a pretty well-funded campaign for Governor Charlie.
Yeah. And I would be willing to bet that when all is said and done and the dust settles on the 2018 gubernatorial election, the money that will have been spent probably will be greater than all the money spent on all the gubernatorial elections before Bruce Rauner came on the scene.
Pretty amazing. Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about the election, even though it's hopefully still far away. It doesn't feel that way. J.B. Pritzker had an issue. Brian Mackey, he had an issue that popped up in the news this week involving property taxes. Can you explain that and his response?
Yeah, well, who hasn't looked at their neighbor's house and thought, you know what, I should buy that and just leave it vacant so I can have some, you know, quiet next door. Just kidding if my neighbors are listening. But that is apparently what Pritzker decided to do in his wealthy enclave, I think is how we describe those types of neighborhoods in Chicago. He bought the house next door, and apparently, and please, Tony, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but made some changes to the house, removing the toilets, things like that, that basically was allowed, you know, you could then, for property tax purposes, declare the house uninhabitable. That brought the property tax rates way down on it. He got a rebate for a number of years on that, or a discount, whatever the term would be, got money back, or lower property taxes. And the Republicans have been having a field day with this, you know, posting pictures that apparently they got from some real estate site showing what appears to be a very nice, you know, fancy house with chandeliers and things like that, and, you know, marble surfaces, and saying, you know, this is J.B. Pritzker's quote unquote uninhabitable house, and just really kind of dinging him for, you know, this property tax move that he made.
And correct me if I'm wrong in this too, but it seems like his campaign has struggled with this a bit because they came out with some trying to tie Bruce Rauner into something similar, and then it turned out later that it was the condo association that was that Rauner belonged to that had actually made that request. There was also some questions about how many years that Pritzker got this tax break. So, not the best week for the Pritzker campaign.
Yeah, and what the Pritzker's campaign has been saying is that, you know, he's appealing the assessment of this and how much in property tax he should have to pay, which the campaign points out. Well, this everybody has the right to do this in Cook County. Everyone does do this. They have some numbers. I think that said like 50,000 people do it, and so that's been their response. To me, the question was, why did you want the house in the first place? This is your neighbor's lot. You know, this is not your main house. And when he said it, he had a very quick availability with the press earlier in the week, and he said, well, it was for security reasons. And that was about as far as we got before he had to be called inside to his campaign event. So I think there's still some more questions about it. I think for as much as we saw Bruce Rauner, his multiple 9 homes be an issue in the 2014 campaign. The fact that one person has 9 homes, I think when you have a candidate who's extremely wealthy, you're going to get into what public records exist on this person, and if they have property, well, there's going to be a lot of public records. And so I think this is the beginning of what we're going to be seeing about J.B. Pritzker.
And Pritzker's dominated on that, I would say, so far in that news cycle for the Democratic primary, the people who've announced. So this has to be probably a bit of good news for those folks who are running against him. They see a little bit of an opening here.
Yeah, it certainly allows people like State Senator Daniel Biss and Chicago Alderman Amaya Pawar to, as well as Chris Kennedy, who nobody really thought of as an underdog at the beginning of this process a couple of months ago, because he himself is quite wealthy, although not Pritzker or Rauner wealthy, apparently. But it allows them to say, you know what, we've tried Illinois government with an ultra wealthy person in charge, and it hasn't worked out from their standpoint as Democrats. And so we need more of a people's candidate, and it lets them wage that sort of up from the grassroots type campaign.
Tony, we got a couple of minutes left here. I wanted you to talk, if you could, about this legislation that involves guns, and the city of Chicago is wanting this law put in place. What's this legislation? What would it do, and what's the controversy that surrounds it?
In short, this bill does is it sends repeat gun offenders to prison for longer. It's basically a mandatory minimum that says if you have multiple offenses of using a gun illegally, you're going to have to go to prison for 7 to 14 years. If a judge is not going to do that, then they have to jump through some hoops and explain themselves why they would not abide by that rule. This is a controversial bill. It's been around. The concept's been around for several years. But honestly, this is coming up because Mayor Rahm Emanuel has been pointing the finger at Springfield for a long time, saying, make these gun laws stricter. And Springfield hasn't passed anything. This is the mayor's way of addressing the city's gun violence that are just, you know, it's in the headlines the every single day. So this is getting a lot of attention at this point, and there's kind of this final push here before the end of session about what are they going to do. Curiously, the bill is being sponsored in the House of Representatives by Republican House Leader Jim Durkin. And so to see the Republican House leader carrying a bill on behalf of Chicago's mayor and police superintendent is noteworthy, mostly because of the history that everything we've been talking about here and how much the mayor and the governor have been at odds. They're coming together on this bill. That said, it's still hitting some roadblocks from the African-American members of the House and the Black Caucus that say this is not comprehensive. This does nothing to – this won't address the gun problem. If you just put somebody in prison for a few years and then you take that person off the street and then they're replaced with three more, then you haven't solved any of the violence issues going on in Chicago. So we'll see where this bill goes. I think it's changing every day, and things I think will be moving pretty quickly here. But it's the politics of this are pretty interesting to watch here.
All right, time for our notes from the field. And Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, another prominent business group came out with recommendations for the state's fiscal condition. It was the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club in Chicago, which represents some of the largest employers in the region. And they are urging the lawmakers and the governor to reach a budget agreement, which they say would require $10 billion in changes. And interestingly enough, they want $8 billion in new taxes and revenue and only $2 billion in cuts. And the report doesn't include term limits or a property tax freeze, two of the items that are on Governor Rauner's must-do list.
And Brian?
Yeah, there was an Illinois Supreme Court case this week involving the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA as it's called. Let's individual citizens, the media, get records from government organizations. The Better Government Association, a good government group in Chicago, tried to use the law to get records of the IHSA. That's the big athletic group that manages high school athletics and competitive events in the state. They were trying to use FOIA to get that, even though that's a non-for-profit, non-governmental agency. The Illinois Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that because they are not really a government agency, even though they deal exclusively pretty much with schools.
And Tony?
Well, unless you think that we could go half an hour and not talk about Donald Trump this week, I'll just bring up the governor's race again and talk about how almost all of the Democratic candidates for governor have called for impeachment proceedings to begin against the president. I believe Bob Diber, I've not heard from Bob Diber, I guess is what I should say, but the other four, Pawar, Biss, Pritzker, and Kennedy have been talking about impeachment. And they're also trying to do this thing where they're trying to call on Governor Rauner to address what's been in the news surrounding everything with Donald Trump. And I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about that in the following year.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Tony Arnold. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us at NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.